Reverend Cooper, Reel One. Could you tell me, first of all, how you first heard about the Falklands crisis, how it came to you?
It came to me initially over the media, that I think it was television news, first said that there was a problem down south. Almost concurrently with that, just perhaps slightly afterwards, my commanding officer, Colonel Jones, talked to me about it. We were due to go to Belize, 2nd Battalion, Parachute Regiment, and in fact our equipment had gone. Colonel Jones, was keen that we should join in the task force, but at that time, the only army battalion I think involved was the 3rd Battalion, who was spearhead, and they'd been recalled from weekend leave. I was running the school shooting, the battalion shooting team, who at that time were down in Tidworth, though we were based in Aldershot, and they had the ranges in use at Tidworth. So when Colonel Jones told me that the situation was deteriorating and it was his hope that we might be involved, I immediately put our shooting team on notice for withdrawing from Tidworth and ensured that I knew where they were at all times so that we could recall them. But my actual first intimation that anything was going wrong came through the media. We were really looking towards Belize and Central America.
But you were the padre in the battalion.
I was a chaplain in the battalion, yes.
And how was it that you came to be so involved with the small arms?
Well, a variety of reasons. One, I shoot anyway as a hobby and shoot for Great Britain. Secondly, I'd done a study of sniping in the army. And this had started really when I was an undergraduate. Out of sheer interest of sniping, and as you may know, the army had actually given up any interest in sniping, and Northern Ireland recreated the need. I'd interviewed a number of soldiers, both British and American, over their experiences of sniping in the Second World War, the Korean War, and subsequently. So I found myself in the position of being about the only person in the battalion who knew a great deal of accurate shooting. And since it's always difficult to find an officer who can run a battalion shooting team, I think I was an ideal person. I wasn't involved in regimental duties and could run the battalion shooting team, which really was pure administration with a bit of coaching on how to shoot straight. That did snowball somewhat. As far as sniping went, because again we had nobody in the battalion with any knowledge or experience whatsoever of sniping, and whilst I had no experience of it, I'd certainly got the recorded experience of a large number of people who I could draw on. Colonel Jones and his second in command, Chris Keeble, were both keen that the battalion should be able to shoot straight and that our snipers should be effective, so I found myself really making variety of suggestions over both the training programme and subsequently the operational deployment of snipers.
What was the next step in your actually going to the Falklands then?
The next step, I suppose, was really when Colonel Jones said that we would be going. At that point, I withdrew the soldiers from the snipers shooting team from Tidworth. And really made my own preparation, which became more on the chaplain's side of making sure I got the equipment that I needed. The issued portable communion set was a fairly bulky item, and although I had one of those, I did know that the chaplain's depot at Bagshot Park had a number of very small and convenient portable communion sets that they'd been trialling. So I went up to Bagshot Park and drew one of these sets, which in fact proved far more useful than the issued set. And then it really became a matter, there was a lot of uncertainty. We knew we were going, we eventually discovered we were going on the Norland, which is a North Sea ferry that had been taken from trade, but it needed certain modifications. And we had a period of perhaps a week when we paraded every morning, ready to go, to be stood down and told I to reappear the next morning. Now, I had a degree of of input in that we'd sent an advance party up to Hull who would join the ship there, and they were then sailing round to Portsmouth where we were embarking, and on that advance party, for example, had been our quartermaster, whose job it was to apportion the cabins and the accommodation to different companies and different units. So I really looked in on him to see what the layout of the ship was, to try to get to some idea of not just what the accommodation would be, but what spaces there were for instructional periods, and just to try to get a feel of how things were going to be. I actually had leave due, it was pre Belize leave, and having spoken to Dave Woods, the adjutant, I said I'd like to get a few days if it were possible. He said, well, you certainly were not going to be going before, I think it was a couple of days' time. I said, okay, well, I'll nip up to Yorkshire, see my parents, and I'll keep in touch daily, and if it, you know, if I have to get back, I'll come straight back. So I had a couple of days at my parents, keeping in touch with the battalion, and then went back again, paraded more or less daily, and then about day three, something like that. I really can't be precise over the times, over the number of times we actually paraded to embark, and then were stood down at Aldershot. We got on the coaches and went down to Portsmouth. We marched from the battalion lines down to Montgomery Square, where the coaches were. It was interesting, the number of soldiers who were carrying soccer balls, this sort of thing. I don't know whether they thought that they were going to have time to play soccer, because at this time there was no clear indication that we were going to fight. Certainly the Argentines had invaded. The task force by now had sailed with our 3rd Battalion. We were then told that we would follow on, and we in fact joined them at Ascension Island. But there was no certainty, even when we got to Ascension Island, that we would be involved in fighting. So when we left Aldershot on the coaches, it was still without any real certainty that we were going to war. And I think probably it's true to say the majority of our soldiers rather thought that it would be over and we would be back really in fairly short time.
So you picked up the Norland at Portsmouth, did you?
We picked up the Norland at Portsmouth, and our families were bussed down as well. So we got there, embarked, stowed away our kit, and then lined the rail. It was a very emotional moment. I suppose not something that a parachute soldier normally experiences, because he wouldn't normally be going away on a ship. The normal practice would be to go to an airfield in the early hours of the morning, and his war would begin there. So it was very different for us in that respect. And very emotional. I think my personal feelings were that we would fight. I from what I knew of the Argentine character, which wasn't a lot, but I didn't think that they would back down. I think thought that would be too much of losing face. So I really did think that we probably would have to fight for the island. And looking round and seeing the size of the force that we were deploying, I was personally pessimistic about the chances of my return. They were obviously very personal thoughts. And talking to others, I think the general feeling was that it was an unnecessary alarm and that nothing would come of it. Most of our soldiers, particularly the younger ones, were keen that there should be some fighting, which I think is understandable. But I think it was an enthusiasm that was born from innocence. And certainly I think their assumption was that if there was any fighting and there were any dead bodies, it wouldn't be us. It would be them that were the bodies. But I did talk to one or two who were I think probably more realistic. And one company commander who said, you know, really this is a bit of an adventure. Adventure in the sense that there was a degree of uncertainty about it, and certainly that the size of force that the government was deploying wasn't that one would expect if we were going to complete an amphibious assault and recover the islands. But again, we didn't know. Our actual orders, as far as they went, were simply that we should set sail, and we assumed the worst and trained for the worst, as a deliberate policy. And once we set sail, we embarked upon a training programme on the Norland that was really quite exhaustive. And every day really started at about 8 o'clock and finished at 9 at night, with breaks for meals and a couple of coffee breaks, morning and afternoon. But really, we worked very hard. And I would think in the time that we were at sea from Portsmouth down to Ascension Island, certainly, we had 2 days off, and we spent both those days on organised sports. So really, there was very little time for anybody, certainly to get bored, and very little time when nothing was happening. We trained extremely hard on the assumption that we would be fighting, and on the assumption that we had really quite a lot of ground to cover before we were in any way ready to go on to active service.
How did you get on with the crew of the Norland?
We got on extraordinarily well with them. I think we were very lucky. The Norland was a small ship and had on board a civilian crew who I understood from Don Ellaby, the captain, who were all volunteers. And there was a small Royal Naval party there as well, under the command of Chris Esplin-Jones. We got on very well with them. I think perhaps because, first of all, we were a battalion group. There were about 1,000 soldiers. The battalion, sappers who supported us, the field surgical team, all airborne, all knew each other, and all fitted together extremely well. We found in the crew, the civilian crew, initially a degree of difficulty in accommodating our timetables. They, of course, were used to a 24-hour turnaround on a North Sea crossing. And I remember one occasion when the lady whose job it was to change the bed linen on about day three, I was just talking to her, and she said, "Well, I've got nothing to do now." So I said, "Well, why is that?" She said, "Well, you know, I changed the bedding and we've no clean sheets left." And so I said, "Well, you know, probably the best thing you can do is just make cups of tea, and when soldiers pass, give them a cup of tea." And she made herself very useful in that very sort of motherly way. But we dominated the ship, so it was our timetable that the ship's crew adapted to. So our training could take place, we had the meals, and we all just went into one of the restaurants. Officers, other ranks, the whole lot, we just piled through in a cafeteria system, ate, and then went about our business. And I think we benefited from that. I suspect had we been perhaps on the QE2, we might have become victim of the ship's timetable, rather than the other way about. And really, the ship's crew became part of the battalion group and fitted into what we wanted very well. And I certainly wasn't aware of any friction. I think Don Ellaby, on one occasion, the captain, seemed a bit... He was concerned, I think, when he discovered that the ship would actually be going into the Falkland Islands. I suspect that when he set sail, he was under the impression that the ship wasn't doing a great deal other than transporting troops from one safe area to another. And I guess, talking to him, that he was concerned when he realised that not just the ship, but that his crew would be exposed to enemy action. And that I got the impression that wasn't actually part of the agreement when they volunteered. But of course, there wasn't a great deal they could do about it. There's nowhere they could go anyway. But having said that, we got a lot of support from them, and I think this, as we filed down the ship to get down onto the car deck of the ship to get into the landing craft and assault the islands, really, Don Ellaby gave a short sort of speech of farewell over the ship's PA system, and I think it was a very moving speech. In all honesty, I can't tell you the content, but I do remember it as being a very moving speech, that we all felt was expressing the feelings of all the ship's crew, of their good wishes, and that really what we were doing, they thought, was the right thing. So we worked very well. There's no friction that I'm aware of. And indeed, I can remember when we were firing weapons off the stern as part of the training sometimes, the ship's crew would join in and be given a rifle or a GPMG and a magazine or belt of 50, 60 rounds or so and invited to have a go.
What happened to you at Ascension?
Not a lot, really, because, of course, the task force had been there some time. As I remember it, we arrived late one afternoon, and we left the following day. We didn't go ashore, and we simply practiced climbing down into a landing craft, where we literally just did a circuit of the ship, and then climbed back aboard. And that really was the only practice we had in either getting into landing craft. We had no practice at getting out of them until we actually went ashore at the islands. Now, that I think we were perhaps unusual. Well, I think we were unique in that the other ships, having been there earlier, had gone ashore and had done some live firing and some exercise, some route, some speed marches and so on. We didn't have that. We went south accompanied by one of the Royal Naval units, the sister ship of the Intrepid, sister ship of the Fearless, and one of the fleet auxiliaries. I have a feeling it may have been Plumleaf or Pearleaf, one or the other, began with a P and a leaf. And we sailed south unescorted to Ascension Island, where we then joined the task force, and thereafter we were part of the task force and therefore in convoy and protected by Royal Naval units all the way down to the Falkland Islands.
What do you remember about meeting up with the task force in the first place?
Well, not a lot, really. I think we knew by the time we got to Ascension Island that we were meeting, that the task force would be there, or at least part of it. My interest was really on the island, it was an island the like of which I'd never seen before. First of all, going through the tropics I found interesting, and the marine life was fascinating. When we got to within sight of the island, it was simply a pile of volcanic ash. And not having seen any island like that before, I was more absorbed by that. And it was really only as we anchored, and I began to look around, that I realised there was a large number of fleet auxiliaries. And my feeling was, or my guess was, that these were the resupply vessels, and obviously that Ascension was going to be the staging post. There were few Royal Naval vessels, presumably because they were either with a task force or at sea anyway. We took aboard some RAF personnel, and I seem to remember that one of the bigger concerns was how cramped it was going to make us. We were fairly tight for space on the ship anyway. Water had been rationed for a while, even by the time we reached Ascension Island. And we ran out of bread shortly after Ascension Island. So I think we were probably more concerned at the actual cramped quarters, moving on the extra personnel. And it really did become a bit tight and uncomfortable after Ascension Island, with everybody squeezed in where they could.
What did you consider your role as a chaplain to be as you went further and further south and it became more and more apparent that you were going to have to fight?
Well, there's nothing laid down anywhere, so I suppose to a certain extent one invented one's own role. I talked to people like Chris Keeble. As we went south, before Ascension Island, I talked to Chris Keeble. He was in charge of the battalion. Colonel Jones had flown down to Ascension Island for a briefing and joined us at Ascension Island. Chris and I spoke about things, and I felt that there were two things I thought that were particularly important. One was that we made sure that soldiers realised that casualty procedures wouldn't be the same on the islands as they were in Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, a casualty became the priority once a casualty occurred. And it was obvious that on the islands that wouldn't be the case. So I was concerned that as far as casualty evacuation and clearance went, and my interest obviously was in the realms of the casualties, and I also worked very closely with our doctor, was that men knew that if they became casualties, they wouldn't necessarily be picked up immediately, but that didn't mean that we'd forgotten them. After Ascension Island, my work in this area became even more pronounced, I suppose, when Colonel Jones asked me to take care of casualty clearance, that is, being responsible for taking casualties from their site of injury back to the RAP. And I was very concerned that soldiers did recognise that they would be picked up as soon as we could, but that it might not be immediately apparent that we were actually in the process of collecting them. And my other side was, or my other concern was that we drew the sort of the teeth of the fear of injury or death, and that soldiers could talk about this without destroying their commitment to what we were about, but equally in accepting that there was a possibility of death and a possibility of injury. The general reaction was that there was a greater fear of injury than death, or at least permanent incapacity rather than death. And I spent a great deal of time talking at platoon level or half platoon level on these topics, and just talking to soldiers and discussing matters. Inevitably, I found myself as well involved in talking with soldiers on a private basis. There was no formal interview. It's simply that I'd find soldiers started to talk to me when we were perhaps in the canteen, or maybe in an odd moment we're just leaning against the ship's rail. And they perhaps want to talk about private matters. It could have been any range of things, from domestic matters that were perhaps unresolved, and they'd suddenly realise that they might not have time to resolve them, and just really wanted to get things off their chest or talk to somebody about it. May have been that they'd left home having had an argument with their wife, something like that, and had suddenly realised that they might not actually ever see her again. Or on another occasion, a soldier came to me, actually it was on the islands, before we attacked Wireless Ridge, but it's a good example of the kind of thing that happened, where he came along and said, "Sir, I'm not superstitious, but tomorrow's the first anniversary of my wife's death." And his wife had died of cancer the year before. And obviously, for him, the proximity of a night attack on the eve of his wife's death the year before was preying on his mind. And it's that level of conversation which I think the soldier might not have felt he could talk to a company officer about, and perhaps might not have felt he could talk to another soldier about. Perhaps a private soldier might, but somebody like, say, a warrant officer, a company sergeant major or a senior rank wouldn't be entirely happy talking to anybody other than at least an equivalent rank, I think, on personal matters like that. So I found myself quite involved in that pastoral work. And obviously, though, in terms of time and effort, a lesser part of the job, taking conventional services, which we had on a regular basis on the way south, and then before we landed and after we'd landed, as and when the opportunity seemed right and the possibility existed.
Were those normal Sunday services or ones?
On the ship they tended to be Sunday services, yeah. Once we got ashore it tended to be more dictated by the event and the circumstances, and to a certain extent the location.
And did you, the Sunday services, did you make the sermon a vehicle for the type of thing that you've just been talking about?
Probably, yes. I can't in all honesty remember a lot of what I said. I can only remember two sermons, and one of those only, somewhat better than the other, which was one service we had a couple of hours before we landed, and the entire battalion was really, we were waiting for the time to get down onto the car decks and into the landing craft. We were cammed up, we were bombed up, we'd got all our kit, and we had a service in the forward lounge, and all the services were entirely voluntary, but on that particular occasion it was packed. And the nice thing about the parachute regiment was that there wasn't any real sort of officers at the front and other ranks to the rear. It really was everybody just piled in. And on that occasion, I think the point I made, well, I know the point I made, was very simply that I didn't believe in a God of causes, but I believed in a God who cared for every individual and who had the capacity for that care to extend beyond the grave. And therefore I said, I don't believe that praying or not will divert the path of a bullet one way or the other. You know, you take your chance along with the next man. But what I did believe was a God who would care whatever happened. And in a sense, I think that sermon was taken up again and maybe completed with the service in Stanley after the campaign, where I suppose all I was doing there was nothing complex, but simply asking soldiers to remember what they were like and how they felt when they really were seeing themselves without any sort of any veneer of any sort. When faced with death, they could see what they really were like and what mattered to them. And really not to forget what mattered to them when circumstances got better.
In Tupara, were they all Christians, or did you have people like Jews or other religions?
Well, I don't know how you define a Christian. I mean, if you're looking at their documents, I suppose the vast majority had put down C of E, or C of E had been put down for them. I don't for a minute think that there were many who were what would normally be called practicing Christians. In terms of non-Christians, or as you say, Jews or Muslims, we had one or two, but literally, I said, I'm not sure about Jews. Tripura had a Jew, certainly, he was killed. We had one or two Muslims, but only one or two. And I don't believe they were practicing Muslims.
Were they Muslims from the Indian subcontinent?
No, they were sort of first, second, perhaps third generation immigrants, really, into Britain. And I was never aware of any problem. You know, they, on the one hand, never seemed to feel that they had a need for any ministry of their own religion. Maybe they did. I wasn't aware of it. Of course, we had Roman Catholics and we had Anglicans, but as far as the Roman Catholics were concerned, there was a Roman Catholic chaplain in the brigade who came round on a fairly regular basis and conducted services and saw such soldiers as wanted to see him when he came.
Now, can we go into the South Atlantic, and can you tell me what your personal memories are then?
After we landed? Or on the ship?
Well, no, the actual getting off the ship and the actual landing.
I was, after the Sheffield had been sunk, and then the Belgrano, I think we all realised that it was serious, that it would be a shooting match, and that we were very vulnerable. There was an odd feeling, really, on the ship when the Belgrano was sunk. There were those soldiers who threw their hats in the air and said, you know, great news. There were others who were a bit more sober, because I think they realised the implications. And the Royal Naval personnel, of whom there weren't many, were very much of the opinion, well, you know, don't cheer, because they are sailors, and I think they probably had a greater awareness than soldiers of what it meant to lose a ship. As we went south, we began to notice preparations, as it were. We had an anti-aircraft defence on deck at all times, other than when the sea or the weather was so bad that they couldn't. These were GPMGs on tripods, mounted on large cans of antifreeze that the Norland had put on board. I think the antifreeze was to go on the decks to stop them freezing. But we used them as some cover and support for GPMGs in an anti-aircraft role. We also had a couple of blowpipe detachments on board who were always on the upper deck with a couple of missiles. The weather deteriorated as we went south, which I suppose was a help.